So, sorry for just a little technical stuff at the beginning here. Here's how I think it's going to go. You ready for this? We're going to start the episode the way we start it. Then we're going to talk. We're going to field questions. We'll just do like a normal episode, except it's live with 200 people here. Okay, sound good?
Let's do it.
And here we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, and how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Lee White.
And I'm Will Terry. And all three of us are professional illustrators. We've all illustrated for all the major publications in the business. We've all taught illustration at art schools, and together we've illustrated somewhere around 50, I'm going to say 70 books.
This
75.
Week,
it's a special
75.
Occasion.
75. Okay.
75. This week we will be fielding questions from our trusty listeners on YouTube, and we are going to be answering them live. So we'll see how it goes. Sometimes we're going to agree. Sometimes we're going to argue. But each time, you're going to learn something brand spanking new.
Brand spanking new. All right. This is our live episode, 100th episode. Our 100th episode. You guys, it's so funny because we were joking about how this thing could just blow up because of tech. Not blow up good, but blow up bad because of technical difficulties. Do you remember the first, 20 episodes we recorded, how every single time something broke? Somebody's microphone wouldn't work. So somebody, the software we were using to record it was would just stop working. Mm-hmm. It was, and we were joking because it was every episode we'd be it's our first time doing it. I don't know. I think it takes 20, maybe 50 episodes.
I don't think, I was going to say 20 is being really optimistic. I mean, I'm thinking last week we're still having problems. But to be fair, they change. You guys know when you go into a different software that you use, they move stuff around all the time and they change it for no reason other than to just say, hey, we updated something and now it's different. And then everybody gets mad because it doesn't work as well as it did. So we fight that a lot.
Yeah. So I think one of our biggest triumphs here by episode 100 is now we can record an episode really without any hiccups,
Well, people are already saying in the chat that the form isn't working. I don't even know what form that is talking about. Is that?
So there's a form they could fill. Let me fill you in on our this episode here. We're doing a giveaway. I don't know if you knew. I don't know if you knew that.
Can I enter?
But we are giving away a prize package to three people, and in order to be eligible for it, you just got to fill out that form, and then we're gonna figure out the announcements. So the form, we're working on getting it in place. For some reason, there's some reason people aren't able to access or enter in information, but we've got
I didn't
David
have any problem filling out my form.
You didn't?
No.
Oh, well, if there's only you, me, and Lee on it, we might win our prize package.
Now, I see people asking questions. Is that how they're supposed to do it in the chat? And then our powers that be are going to relay those questions to us, so we don't need to be...
Exactly. So if you have a question for us today, put it in the chat. And then Daniel, who is our podcast producer, he's going to copy and paste it over to our... Zoom meeting so that we can filter out and see what the questions are, and then get back. So apparently the form doesn't have the permissions are only people who made the form can fill it out. It needs to be available for everybody. If we can't get it to work, we're just going to have, we're going to figure out another way. Don't worry. Three random people will win something by the end of this episode. All right.
See how it goes. I'm seeing all these good questions come in. I kind of just want to answer them quick fire, but I know I shouldn't do that.
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. So should we, before we get into questions, I just want to ask you guys, if your memory serves you, what was your favorite episode so far? And I want to know from you and Will. And Lee and Will, And I want to know from the people in the chat, what if they have a favorite episode, what was it?
I like the embarrassing stories. Those are just always so fun to tell. They're fun to listen to, I think.
Yeah, that was a good one. Especially your embarrassing stories, Lee.
I have quite a few. They're doozies.
They're really good. Well, did you have a favorite episode of this first 100?
My favorite ones are the ones where I sounded intelligent. There weren't too many.
It was like episode 3, I think.
Yeah, they were rare. You know what I really liked was the first episode because it had the most views and it was my idea.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The reason it has the most views, though, is because when people come to our podcast, they read, they listen to the first one first. So it's more about it being the first episode than any good quality, I think.
Hey, take credit no matter what. Don't even worry about it. You get the credit.
Oh, boy. Let's see. I wonder if, okay, questions are rolling in. Everything episode with a list of Jake is the best. That's a good answer. Any episode that has one of my lists in it. I think it's been a while since I've done a list because we're just shooting from the hip on a lot of these questions that come in recent episodes. But, you know, it'd be nice to just roll out a good old fashioned list of things you got to do. I think that'd be great. Right, me personally, my favorite episode, I can't, I'm drawing a blank now. I can't remember anything we've done up to this point.
A lot of people in the chat are talking about the episode where I was talking about getting caught throwing carrots and food.
Oh, yeah.
You guys remember that? I thought that happens to everybody, but I guess that might be a unique experience.
Right. Anyways, we got a few questions coming in here, but I just want to say first off, before we get into that, that we had no idea how this thing would go, or even that we'd ever reach 100 episodes, and I just think it's so like really cool that the people that listen to this podcast are kind of what make it what it is and what's like worth doing, right? Like, I read all the reviews that we get, but not only that, like I get comments on Instagram posts that I do. I get messages sent to me. I get emails sent to me. I'm sure you guys do the same. And more often than not, it's about the podcasts. It's just, you know, thank you for answering the questions. It's helped me. It's guided me on this path. So I just want to say it's hard to like respond to everything, every message that people send, but I just want to like publicly say here, thank you so much, everybody, for listening to 3-Point Perspective and for sharing it with people and for just being a part of it. So you guys are great.
Yeah. And all the questions have been so interesting. You know, I hope you guys are feeling comfortable sending in the questions because, you know, it might feel like an obvious question. You're like, oh, I don't want to ask that. But then we get these questions every week. And it's like, oh, my God, I got two of them just sent to me privately this week that were fantastic questions that I never even thought about before. And so, keep sending them in. Even if you think it's either obvious or embarrassing or whatever, just send it in. We like it. We like to see it all.
Yeah. My biggest regret. Did you have something too, Will? No.
No, my wife's asking what's going on. I said we're recording the 100th episode right now.
Oh, and she's like, oh, is that a big deal? I know, my wife too. She's like, now what do you have going on today? It's the 100th episode. It's a big deal. We're having a live, you know, a live streaming it. There's going to be people there. She's like, oh, okay, cool. Do you think you can pick up Calvin from school? I'm like, I can't do it. I'm going to be doing this. All right, let's do first question. Okay,
right, here we go.
Okay, this comes from Brett. Hi, Jake, Lee, and Will. Congrats on getting to 100. Woo! My question is regarding style. I'm currently putting together a children's book portfolio, but my style influences tend to be closer to animation, such as Studio Ghibli, Laika Films, and the work of Sylvain Chomet. I like the idea of cel-shaded characters on painterly backgrounds. Is this a viable style for children's books? What do you guys think? You're familiar with those styles, right? Have you heard of Studio Ghibli? It's Miyazaki.
Check that out.
Laika, have you heard of them?
I think Laika's a different style. I mean, you're dealing with like kind of quirky stop motion animation with Laika. So a different style than he's asking about here. But I think it's going to be tough, to be honest with you. And it also depends on the market that you're in and where you're located on in the world. If it's for U.S. publishers and Canada, I would say, and then probably Europe as well, I don't think it's going to be as successful. I think it'd be tough to do that style, to be honest.
You know Red Nose Studio?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That does so, the maquettes.
Yeah. So I look at that, and I don't know how successful the books are, but whenever I see the books done through that studio, which essentially Red Nose Studio is, they make little scale models with characters. All the characters have red noses, I think. That's kind of the the shtick, right? But they look like they're photographs taken, and it's just a very like engaging way to do illustration. So I think if you did something like that, it would find an audience, find a market, and it might be something interesting enough for a publisher to be like, yes, this is, you know.
Yeah, but Red Nose Studios, you're kind of going into that Laika realm, but he's talking more specifically about a flat shaded character on the more realistic background.
Right. Yeah.
And
yeah,
I don't.
So I want to, so that aside, I think if you can do that sort of thing, I think it's unique enough that you could do it. Cel shaded children's books, part of me is like, I don't see it out there. And I want to see something that looks like that. I think that would be kind of cool. Like,
it seems like you see more stuff in graphic novels that resembles that.
That's definitely a thing I've seen done in graphic novels, yeah. But in kids' books, it might be something that could be done really well. Especially if like the backgrounds look painted like a painterly background, but then the characters were all cel shaded. I think that might be cool.
The thing is, no one can say no, that would never work in children's books,
right?
Because as soon as you put an absolute on something, you're going to see it.
Yeah.
Is it shooting for the middle? No.
Yeah.
So it's like, do you want to shoot for the middle and try to look like other people and fit in? Or do you want to just do your thing and be happy and hope that you can find a home for it and be okay, you know, be content if it doesn't find a home, but be really happy that you're really unique if it does.
Yeah,
there's no never and there's no always, but it's just kind of trying some stuff out and seeing what hits.
So there's this thing, and I was reading about this on Austin Kleon's blog, and it's experimentation versus exploitation, right? So as a creator, you're always like, how do you balance these two? And experimentation is, here's something new. Let's try this out. Let's see if it works. Oh, that didn't work. Let's try this. Let's try this out. See if it works. And then exploitation is, once it works, you use it and you run with it and you go for it. And you have this like this streak of success with it because you're exploiting something that you found work. So you're in this stage now where it's experimentation. And I say, throw it out there, see what works, see what doesn't work. And if something starts to work, exploit it and lean into it and run with it. So
Preston is saying that the form is fixed. So you guys give it a whirl if it didn't work before. This is going to be the most generic description ever. There was a movie that was animated that sort of came from that Studio Ghibli look, but then had a little bit more illustration style. And it was this little boy in these big city environments. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about? The name of it?
Finding Nemo.
No.
Nemo in Slumberland.
God, I know not to ask you guys a question. I know it's such a vague question. I'm gonna find it because I showed
a little boy in a big city.
He's in a big city. It's a full feature film. It takes place in, I guess, like downtown Tokyo is what it looks like.
Brother Bear.
Well, while you're looking for that, I'm gonna ask the next question.
Well, before you do, there was a good comment from Mallory in there where she's saying that the story, if the story's really good, the style will probably matter less. And I think I agree with that.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. But I think a children's book's style is such an overwhelming part of the experience. You gotta really nail it.
I'm gonna find this movie. While you're getting ready, I'm gonna find this movie because it is the perfect blend of children's book and what Brett was asking about.
Okay.
Hold tight.
Question: are there any exercises y'all do daily or weekly? I assume art exercises, but physical exercises. We all like Will's into pickleball. I'm into running. Lee's into biking. Art exercises. Do you guys do art exercises or is it like straight to work?
I mean, I do doodle drawings. Mm-hmm. I try to keep the skills up. And so I keep my iPad handy and try to get some drawings in, but not a formal exercise.
I'll show you something I've been working on, and that's just trying to get better at heads. So this is my sketchbook, and I've got
You need some help.
A few head pages. I know. Where's another head page here, I think. So, sometimes I'll just focus on a thing and work on it and try to get a little bit better, try to get some muscle memory for that. I know the question isn't so much about what do we do, but it's more what should a person work on and exercise with weekly or daily. But I would have a daily practice of doing something in your sketchbook and focusing on one particular thing that you're not good at. So,
and that's really the key.
Yeah.
People tend to draw the things that they're good at because they're just, it's fun. It's easy. And we tend to gravitate towards the things that are easy. Right. And you've got to force yourself to do the things that you're not good at if you want to become.
Ah, there it is. Tech on Concrete. Thank you, Angie.
Yes, Tech on Concrete. That's cool. That's a good anime.
That's the one you guys checked that one out.
It's a Western director. I think it's a European director who moved to Japan and made it. So,
dude, see, that's the perfect blend. Check that one out because they really did, I think, nail the characters in a way that doesn't stand out too much from the background. They integrated it. Anyway, back to this this question. Sorry for cutting you off, Will. Continue.
No. I'm done.
You're done. Okay, my exercise now. This is going to sound either really stupid or really smart. That's my go-to. Is I've started taking breaks and waiting and figuring out what do I need to be drawing, what do I want to be drawing, and I think too much in our society now, in our culture of learning art education, we are just moving the pencil too much and not thinking or not slowing down and picking your direction. And so that's why I think you should do some 30-day challenges. You shouldn't just look to 30-day challenges because what it does is it fulfills a quick need. I need to draw something. Here, I'll draw 30 mermaids in May. But it might not be the thing that you need to do.
Yeah.
And so I just say back off a little bit. I mean, take even a week. Don't draw anything. Look around. Like Jake says, fill the creative bank account. And then what I'm adding to that is pick your route. Where do you want to go and how are you going to get there? And be a little more deliberate about it than just, I need to draw because I'm an artist and if I don't draw every day, I'm not getting better. And I think sometimes that's a detriment to you actually advancing.
Yeah. For example, you can get so caught up in like building your reference archive and searching and being like, oh, that's a cool building design. I need to save that for later. Or that's a cool like composition. Oh, I need to save that for later. And it makes you feel like you're productive because you're working, you're looking at stuff, you're looking at cool art, you're getting ideas, you're getting inspired, but none of it matters until you sit down and start making a thing. And what I found is that like this last couple of weeks, I've been laying out a comic, and what matters more is that this comic has a story and it has characters and it's working on that level. And I'm realizing all the reference that I've like absorbed over the last couple of years, 1% of it is actually applicable to this project that I'm working on. And so if I was more focused on, here's a project I want to make, fill it in as best as I can, then realize, oh, these are all the holes that I need to go get reference for, then my reference time will be shorter and more focused, and I could pull in and apply, oh, this building design can go here, this car design could be good reference for that here, you know, I could take photos of this character, you know, this of myself in this pose and use that there, instead of just needlessly adding to a pile of reference that you may or may not never use. Okay, next question.
Can I answer a peripheral question here, because it kind of goes with it?
Absolutely.
I can't remember when we were talking about it, but I was recently talking about, when do you go from being a working on technique to doing actual illustrations? And my answer there was, you should always be working on things that are interesting to you. And I think sometimes there's too much focus on, okay, I've got to get these. You should get your foundation down, but it should be at the service of making images that you're interested in, instead of getting lost in technique. Like, okay, I'm going to study perspective for 2 years, and then I'll start worrying about what I'm actually drawing. And I think that's a weird way to go about it. I think you can make interesting artwork from the beginning, and just don't get lost in being in study mode. You should be in creative mode. We did an interview yesterday where the artist was talking about the story. She just had to get this story out. It took years to get it out. And then all her experience was at service of getting that story out. It wasn't like, oh, I got to be a good artist, so I need to learn perspective and all these other color before I do this story. It was really just about the story. And it came about over years, but she just built it up over time, if that makes sense. So watch out for making your art at the service of technique, instead of making it at the service of making interesting work.
Yeah. You should be trying to love what you're doing when you wake up in the morning, like, oh, exactly. I get to work on this thing, you know, and be learning at the same time. That's cool.
We get to eat our dessert first, you know.
Okay, so here's a question. This is the old Procreate versus Photoshop thing, but this is pretty specific. This is from Susan. She says, if an illustration first worked on in Procreate in color, do you have experience on how much adjustment would be needed when brought into Photoshop for printing? So you made an illustration in Procreate, you bring it into Photoshop, you want to get it printed. What do you got to do? Anything? Just hit print?
You have to set your color profile in Photoshop if you're going to print correctly. Don't be lazy and don't think that it doesn't matter like Jake does.
Just hit print.
I hit print. No, I don't. You see? I'll tell you what. Here's my sample or my bet for that. Take your artwork, put it into Photoshop, and pick two different printer profiles at random and print. Hit print and watch what comes out of your printer. It will be a vastly different thing. You need to know which one to use. And if you don't know which one to use, go with Adobe 1998 RGB.
Vastly different or like it can
throw the colors off a massive spectrum.
It's that much different to us, like that, maybe. Lee sees that as that, so you got to zoom out to
no
see
no 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 people. I'll challenge you guys at home right now, if you got a printer hooked to your computer, if you're watching this on a computer, print two things with different profiles. I mean, some of the profiles will be close, of course, but if you just randomly pick, like Jake, Jake's a dartboard. He throws the dart at the dartboard, whatever profile.
But it always works for us.
Does it? Mm-hmm. Didn't want to say anything.
Here's the thing, though. The person who ends up seeing your print, they don't know what it originally looked like on Procreate, and that hue of magenta is like 2 degrees north
you guys
of what it
change
should be.
Your color profile to Adobe RGB 99. Don't keep it on that screen setting that it's automatically on, the sRGB screen. That's what it'll default to a lot of times.
Okay, so here's a question from SJ. How do you make the leap between feeling good about your ability to copy others' artists' works for practicing purpose or like doing master's studies? So how do you feel good about making the leap from that to designing your own stuff that you actually are happy with? Mm-hmm. So I assume this is like, I can do a really good reproduction of like a Maurice Sendak, you know, illustration. But then when I go to draw my monster hanging out in the jungle, it looks like poop. Like, how do you bridge that gap? I got an answer.
Go ahead. Because I don't really understand the question that well.
So what do you tell an artist who's really good at like doing master studies and copying other work, but then their own work like really stinks?
I understand the problem.
But yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. I want to hear your
answer. So here's the next step in between to where you start to really feel good about your own stuff. And what I like to do is you study Maurice Sendak for a month and you do a bunch of master studies and you're like, okay, I can draw, I could pretty much get his style. Okay. The next step is pick something that Maurice Sendak never drew, like a Harry Potter cover, something that you're familiar with, and draw, well, how would Maurice Sendak design a Harry Potter cover? How would he do Harry, you know? And so now what you're doing is you're starting to fuse in, like fold in your own imagination and your own abilities and your own skills. But you could still lean on Maurice, but it's a way to like bridge it. And then the next level is you're going to study another art. You're going to study Dr. Seuss, or you're going to study Sean Tan, or you're going to study, I almost said Pat Sajak. He's not a children's book illustrator. What was I thinking? I forgot what illustrator I was thinking on. But you're going to study these guys, and then you're going to say, what would it look like if Dr. Seuss and Maurice Sendak had a baby and they designed a Harry Potter cover? Mm-hmm. And pretty much that's how you mix style. Like, you look at any artist's style and you're like, oh, I could see a little bit of this influence, a little bit of that influence, but it's something completely your own.
That's a really
unique.
Good answer. That's how I got my style. I combined a lot of different illustrators that I was looking at and doing that very thing, saying, how would they do this? And then trying to change it up enough so that it didn't just look like theirs. And in the beginning, yeah, I got accused of looking too much like Mary Grand Prix, looking like Steve Johnson, Lane Smith.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, this is,
and that's
Lane
okay.
Smith
it does.
Stage.
It doesn't last. Yeah, it doesn't last. Everybody has that phase, yeah. And mm-hmm. you get so enamored with one artist, and you think that they've got it all solved, and you sort of mimic it, and then you've got it solved, but yeah. It doesn't stick because it's not really you. They arrived at it organically, and then
right.
You arrived at it academically, and so you're going to change too.
Yeah,
I was going to say Dan Santat instead of Pat Sajak. It's the same amount of syllables, three-letter first name.
It does sound the same. There's like a pitter-patter of
I
a
wonder
sound
if
with
Dan
those.
Santat. I wonder if Dan Santat could do Pat Sajak's job.
That's a question. That is a good question.
You know,
if he's ever has time to come on this podcast for an interview, we will ask him.
Isn't he dead?
Ask him that. No, but did you see he hit his head on a counter and got it?
I was talking about Pat Sajak.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Dan Santat.
No. I know Dan's not dead. Oh my gosh.
Wow.
See, this is what happens on the live.
Daniel,
the live show.
Can you edit the live stream?
Okay,
is
next.
Still alive? Am I? Didn't he?
Yes, he's still alive, but he's like 70. I don't know. I honestly think he's like they inject him with formaldehyde because he still
looks good.
Somewhat young.
He looked
the
good.
Guy that just died was the guy that did Jeopardy.
Oh, that's right, Pat Sajak.
Not Pat Sajak.
Pat.
Alex Trebek.
Alex Trebek. Pat yes. Alex Trebek. This is his full name.
Okay, you ready for the next question? This comes from Melody. What are some things you wish you knew before becoming an illustrator?
Oh, there's a lot of them.
So, yeah, what's one of them, Lee?
I wish I knew.
That's a great
question.
I
wish I knew a little bit more about how a business worked and what mm-hmm. to look for in building my business and how to set appropriate goals. It was just strange that how much focus is on making the art and mm-hmm. and really not being a successful person. And then something we've been talking about on this podcast for the past couple of years is what kind of life do you get with each avenue of mm-hmm. illustration, and it's all different. If you're an editorial illustrator, it's one kind of life, and it's fast-paced, and the money tends to be small increments, but you do a lot more work. And then, you know, children's book is slow, and you get paid like once or twice a year if you're lucky, and mm-hmm. you got to make that money last a long time. Those are skills. Those are not just freebies. Those are skills to be developed just like your art skills. And I wish I just had a little bit more of that training in early before I spent more money than I needed to and spent more time than I needed to trying to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree there, because you, even if you talk to like doctors and lawyers and dentists and plumbers and like anybody who practices a trade that isn't going to go work for some big company, but who has like a trade skill, they learn in college how to do that, but then they don't know how to run a practice. They don't know how to like run a partnership. They don't know how to run a dental office. Like that's all stuff that you sort of either pick it up from other people who have done it, or you learn on your own, or you take like a minor in business in college or something like that. So it'd be cool. It'd be really valuable to you if you, going into illustration, also supplemented your knowledge with like reading business books or signing up for an MBA like minor or something like that, or taking some training, online training or something like that on how to run a business. Or, you know, one of my assistants, Aaron Painter, he minored in business. He majored in art, minored in business. And he just totally, upon graduating, like understood how to do the business side. I thought it was super cool. So so that's one of the things for me as well. It's like, oh, there's the art creation, there's the business side. What about you, Will? Was there anything?
I have two.
Yeah.
So one is how important it is, or would have been, for me to value learning good drawing skills early on. Mm. So when my teachers were telling me how important it was to trust them and to really be able to build up any, you know, to draw any object, the skills of, learning how to manipulate the simple shapes like, you know, cubes and cones and spheres and, I guess anybody can manipulate a sphere, but like a cylinder, and to be able to put objects together, to be able to draw a vehicle or any object from any angle out of my head. Because if you can do that, I mean, that opens so many, it makes you so much faster. There was a question that was going by in the chat, you know, like, what do you have any tips to becoming faster? That's one. It took me so long to design illustrations in the beginning because I couldn't draw, and I didn't realize how much that was hampering me. So that'd be the first thing, is to really value that. And if you can't draw any object, any common object that you can think of out of your head from any angle, above you, directly above you, below you, to the side, looking down, you know, then you need to continue working on those drawing skills. The second one will be kind of like the whole idea of, I wish I'd known how to buy Apple, you know, early on. to start Mark Crilley's channel, YouTube channel, before he did. You know, the one where he draws an eyeball or a water droplet or a...
Yeah.
That guy makes a lot of money.
Yeah. But I don't want to trash anybody who makes a ton of money on YouTube. But no. At the end of the day, that's a whole different avenue of illustration. Like, and part of it is you have to be entertaining as well. And not everybody has that ability to be able to draw and be engaging and entertaining. And so for me personally, like, I don't want to have a massively successful YouTube channel, because that means I've also leaned in hard on being entertaining and being more of a personality than a illustrator who makes, you know, books and commentary on, you know, not commentary, but like makes books and adds to the like the social conversation of what's happening in pop culture, you know. That was a sloppy way to say it, but
I want to add to what Will's saying. I don't know if this is a true argument of what Will's saying, because I want to, I do agree with what he's saying there. But to counter that a little bit, I wish I knew how important design was in illustration, graphic design, I guess, for lack of a better term, how the spaces, how a silhouette works. You know, you talk about speeding up your process, getting a good silhouette, you're halfway there. If you have a bad silhouette, you need to save it with every single art skill you have. No, it's hard to even say, even with all your skills, it's hard to save a bad silhouette. And so design being so important, I wish there was a little bit more focus on how to compose with good design and basic shapes, how to lay out an image. Because in my early years of teaching, or I guess in all my years of teaching, sometimes the hardest kids to teach were the ones who could actually draw really well, because they'd try to save a bad design with a good drawing. And it was just work the whole time. It's pulling teeth because everything is drawn so well, but the overall thing doesn't work. If that makes sense. And then to go along with that too, I think there, oh my God, I'm going to get jumped on for this one, but how little importance drawing naked people is in practical. It's such a leftover of the Renaissance art training. It's so stupid. And we spend so many years drawing these naked people, and this false importance gets placed on drawing naked people. And then you go into your major, and you're like, oh wait, I've never drawn a naked person since then. I mean, I understand construction, like what Will's saying, and you know, Jake's How to Draw Everything class, that is so important, but I could draw this Cintiq holder and it's the exact same principle, and I'm not lost in that whole world for years, learning how tendons go together and muscles attached to tendons and stuff. And so I'm even sculpting a head, which I have somewhere around here. It just wastes.
That's a really good advice, because common wisdom is, oh, you better learn your life drawing. Life drawing is so important. And I agree with that, but it's not the end all be all. Like you should have an understanding of it. Well, especially like if you're in your style, Lee, you're such a stylized illustrator. Same with you, Will. Like, when does the deltoid need to be defined in any of your illustrations? You know,
so that's a debate that I've actually had with several colleagues, that teach at art school on how important figure drawing is, and it really isn't as important unless you're doing figurative work. I mean, it turns out
if you're going to be a comic book artist, absolutely, got to get that stuff figured out.
Yeah.
And you know, you're going to draw people in spandex for your career, then you should take some life drawing classes.
But the one of the more, and all those skills lend themselves to the potpourri of all your skills, right? Mm-hmm. So, but I just lost my earpiece with my animated hands. There we go.
Okay.
But you know, we had a class called Drawing for Animation. Mm-hmm. And that was at UVU, and that was kind of the mix of two worlds of designing. You know, you go into a figure drawing class, and usually the teacher poses the figure, right? Mm-hmm. But in this class, they'd have the students pose the figure sometimes for their assignment. Mm-hmm. You know, so learning how to use that figure to make it into an illustration, right, into the right pose, and then drawing from that rather than, you know what I'm saying? And also being able to stylize from that life figure. So,
and I'm not saying everybody shouldn't draw the figure. If you need it, do it. But it just seems to be a sort of a leftover. And drawing the clothes, I used to teach drawing the clothed figure, and then I started teaching drawing the stylized clothed figure. And oh my God, we got some of the coolest drawings ever. And then it was a one-to-one relationship with bringing characters like that into your story. Mm-hmm. So there was an end goal. Like, here's why we're drawing this thing. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times those beginning classes are just, oh my God, they're so boring.
Yeah. I think,
well, and you're drawing shapes. You're drawing shadow shapes, and you're drawing, you know, things that don't really help you draw the figure in a pose that you're going to be able to use. Anyway, sorry, Jake, I cut you off.
Well, I don't know a ton about traditional like education outside of art education, but it seems like my kids are in like these high level math classes, and it's beyond anything that I know. I can't help them. My wife helps them, but they're like, Dad, how do I do a cosine, X variant, whatever? And I'm just like, I don't understand it, but I understand that they're training their brain to think in ways that my brain wasn't trained to think in. Like, they may not need to ever use math in that regard. They might not be an engineer. They might not be a mathematician. They might not be a chemist or whatever. But their brains are trained to kind of think in those relationships and understand certain things that way that help in other aspects and other areas. And I think that's what life drawing is for artists, is you take it, you learn, you understand shape and form and light and shadow and how it falls over the body. And then you go and apply that to your children's book illustrations. Once you've taken life drawing of humans, it makes it much easier to draw animals, because a lot of these same principles apply. Even though you're not drawing Leonardo da Vinci style drawings all the time. Next question. Okay, if you were to start over as a professional artist but still keep your skill level, would you change what kind of projects you took on? So it's the year is 2022. You are a 22-year-old, Will and Lee. What would you do today with the skill level you have now?
I'm still confused about that. Say that again. I'm now young again.
You get to take your skills back in time.
No. Let's say you have your skills. You have a 40-year career ahead of you, not 20 or 10 years.
Oh, I get to go be younger today with my current skills. Right.
I'll do the exact same thing I'm doing now.
Okay. See, that's arrogantly.
I do what I do. I do what I want to do, and I'm doing what I want to do. So if I went back and I had the same skill, I would also do it.
You didn't make any mistakes.
He loves what he does, and he does what he loves.
Oh, I thought you were saying, what would I do now? Like, if I was just transported back, I'm 20, I would do now the things that I've already learned to do. Isn't that sort of obvious?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
Right.
So, Will, what would you do different? Like, would you...
Starting out today?
Yeah.
Well, the market is so different today, too. So I would definitely do a lot more personal projects because now we have avenues to get those out. So I would,
I understand the question now. Okay.
Yeah. So I would do a lot more of that. One of the mistakes that I made was I took on everything because we were not consciously living by the Leyendecker credo, which was to spend more than you make. When I was, first married and dumb.
You were spending more than you made.
Yeah. I'm smart now, by the way. I was dumb then.
Yeah.
So I took on every illustration project. And at the same time, Brett Hellquist I talk about him a lot on the podcast because we were friends and he started his career a year after I did. And
get him for an interview. I want to interview that guy.
We zoom, zoom forward and all of a sudden he's further along. And my take is every project that he took, he figured out how to love. Mm-hmm. And there were so many, I had hundreds, probably over 1,000 projects that I took on that I hated. And so because of that, I probably burned a lot of bridges and an art director isn't going to tell you, hey, and by the way, I'm never going to hire you again. They're not going to say that, right?
They're just going to be nice working with you. And
you
then
just won't ever get hired by them again.
Put your contact info in the trash.
and so that's there's a luxury there of having, the means to be able to say no, because, but I think you can afford to say no if you live well below your means, if you can. And we were living above our means, so I had to say yes. Right. So that's something that I would definitely change.
So Lee, you would be not making you'd be making a tarot deck today if you were 22 and could still draw the way you draw, create what you create.
I'd do that the same, but I do want to add that, like, there's there's reasons that you do the things that you do. Like the reason that Will took those jobs and I took those jobs too, was because you needed to make the money to pay your rent. And so you might not have been, maybe you could have been more invested in it, but there's a certain time in your life where you work a certain number of hours, and that's, you know, short lived, but it's a few years. And almost every successful illustrator I know had those years, whether it was in school or then, you know, when they got out of school. You're overworked, the quality sort of goes down, but you're putting in all these miles. And, you know, I think back to almost, you know, using an analogy, like the first house that I bought was I'm not kidding you. It was a house that squatters lived in. There was candle wax on the floor from where they squatted in my house, and the doors were busted off the hinges. Literally, that was my first project, is putting these doors on the hinges. And looking back on it, I don't live in a house like that now, but that was the only house I could afford. And that was sort of my conditions. And that was what I could do. And that's how I got in and, you know, learned a lot along the way, because I had to fix the certain things with that one. Then I upgraded to the next thing and the next thing. And that's sort of the pattern. And I wouldn't get rid of that. It was important to go through what I had to go through to make the decisions to end up where I'm illustrating a tarot deck that I care about right now, or doing whatever I care about right now.
Yeah. I'm sort of in the same thing. Like in your 20s, I want to tell you, and people in their 40s and 50s can back me up, 60s even, right? I don't know if we have any 70-year-olds here today. If we do, thanks for joining us. I'm glad you're into art and illustrating, and I hope to be there too in my 70s. But something happens around 40 where you need to sleep longer, and you're just tired, and you like, after 5 hours of work, you're like, I'm done for the day. Like, you guys saw that. You felt that, right? But I remember in my 20s where I'm just like, you know, it's 10 o'clock at night, and I'm like, and I've been working, you know, all day, and I'm like, sweet, I still got like 5 hours left in me, you know, left in the tank. You know? Yeah, and you could pull an all-nighter.
And you have to.
Yeah. And so, you know, honestly, if like I was 22 right now and I could do what I could do today, I would have a day job and just be grinding on like personal work. I'd have a day job for money, and then I'd be doing the most like personal stuff that I knew could find an audience, and just be working on that. And
would you work on comics? Like,
yeah, I'd be doing comics.
Try to get a comic out there that could become a Hellboy or something like that.
Yeah, like that. Right.
If you're older, I see a lot of comments right now, people that are starting a little bit older. The benefit that you have is you're smarter, and you may not have to grind as many hours, because it's working with quality, not necessarily quantity. But the only way I got to the quality was with the quantity, because I didn't know what I was doing. And so, like I was saying earlier, you're shooting off in all these different directions, studying things you shouldn't study. And then you have to change course. If you're older, you just have to make smarter decisions. And again, slow down and pick your path deliberately. You shouldn't have to grind a ton if you're making the right choices and studying in a deliberate way.
Okay. How about this? This is from Griffin. What should the art to business ratio be for an illustrator? How much time do you give to art? How much time do you give to business?
In an ideal world, or realistically? Because I used to think being an illustrator
what's
doing
the aim? Yeah, what's the aim?
The aim is doing more illustration. The reality is I feel like it's a treat when I actually get to illustrate. It's meetings, it's revisions, it's all this other emails and all this other stuff, updating a website and all that goofy stuff. And then when you actually sit down in front of the drawing board and you have a couple of hours, it's like, oh my gosh, thank you, finally.
Yeah.
Well, there's the person that has the rep, and they probably have the most time to illustrate, right?
Yeah.
If they
essentially have a business partner.
Yeah. They have a rep, and they're doing freelance and personal work. So they have their website to take care of, and then they have their taxes to do, and the rep is handling pretty much everything else. But we've complicated our lives with multiple businesses and things like that. So it's not really a fair comparison to say, oh my gosh, we're doing all this business because we've chosen that.
I would say there's a thing where I guess scientifically in studies show that 4 hours a day is what the human brain can handle for like very focused, deep flow style work. And then you can like, you know, if it's in comic booking, if it's inking where you're just going back over your lines and doing some nice inking work, or if it's, I don't know, rendering on a painting, where you can like talk to someone on the phone and stuff like that, you could do that all day, right? So what I would do is organize your day in a way and your week in a way where you can get into that flow state every day, typically in the morning, and then leave your afternoons to do the stuff that require, you know, lower mental function or busy work or business work. So just say, I'm not going to answer emails until afternoon. I'm not going to do calls. I'm not going to do calls until the afternoon. I'm not going to, you know, just clear your mornings and make that for illustration, and then let your afternoons be a combination of business and like, you know, all the other stuff that he was saying.
Me and Jake are kind of working on a schedule. I don't know if Jake's still doing it, but we talked about the 4 hour block in the morning, 3 or 4 hour block in the morning, then an hour and a half of exercise, whatever, get a little bit of lunch, and then do a lighter, you know, admin kind of session, business session later in the day. And that's your day. And I tell you, since I've been doing that pattern for about a year and a half, I guess, and it is.
Stay right in front of your mic, because every time you go this way, you like.
That system works so well, is to get the creative stuff out, then do some exercise, then do the light admin stuff that doesn't require a ton of energy, a ton of mental capacity. And it just tends to work. Now, some of you guys may be real late night people. Those are going to be the 25 and under crew typically at this point. But you can just adjust whatever the hours are. Just make sure you got that 4 hour block, whether it's after midnight and everybody's gone to bed and you're just like, oh, I got the house to myself or whatever. But just organize it. But I tell you, that 4 hour block in the morning, then exercise and light stuff is a good one if you don't know where to start.
Yep. Really good. Okay. Let's see here. Do you think interdisciplinary work is dead? In a capitalist society, it seems the only way to be profitable is to hyper specialize, which is hard for creatives. So do you focus in on one? Like, are you master of one or are you a jack of all trades?
You're an ABC.
Okay, let's explain that.
The A is your 65% effort of the work that you're doing. And then you can have a kind of a B interest. And that is, you know, 15, 20%. And then you have just dabbling 10% left over just for exploration and fun.
I like that. That's a good answer. Well, do you feel like you have to specialize, or you can have a successful career as like, I'm a illustrator who also does graphic design or whatever.
I mean, I've always felt like your time is probably better spent really pushing one style. There used to be a lot more market for people to do multiple styles, I feel like. And, mm-hmm. I feel like what happened was when the internet came out and it allowed everyone kind of a real democratic ability to cheaply show their work, it gave art buyers the opportunity to just basically pick and choose from that group, from a larger group, actually. And the cream kind of always rises to the top. So I have always felt that if you spread your time between multiple styles and multiple disciplines, you're probably not going to be able to hone in. There's always exceptions to that. But in general, I feel like that's your time's better spent really, really focusing in on one style and really, really perfecting it.
Cool.
Yeah. Most of the time, when people think they have different styles, they really don't.
Yeah.
A lot of my students get nervous, like, "Oh, I really went out on a limb on this one," and it's like, "No, that looks the same as the stuff you did last time." And it just, you just like slightly changed it. And I think everybody has that perception. You slightly change it. I've changed whole mediums before and sent it in. My clients don't even know.
Do you think my more colorful painterly style is different than my cross-hatching style, like for Bonaparte?
Only in value.
Oh, okay.
Only in hue. If you went black and white,
because the one's more pastel and the other one's more saturated.
Yeah. And I mean, you got and then one's obviously the black and white cross hatching and stuff. But they're similar. I mean, they both look like Will Terry. It looks like you're doing something different. There's a little bit different of an interest there, but it's still Will Terry. Same world.
Yeah. I mean, I think people can find art jobs like I'm going to paint a mural over here. I'm going to do some illustration over here. I'm going to sell some stories or whatever, you know, some other creative thing over here, and they can piece together an income. But I think that the highest paid artists probably have like one main thing going.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to set yourself up for making the most money, that's probably
well, especially if you're going to work at like a animation studio, a game, anything in entertainment, like you better specialize because that's what they're hiring for. Okay. How would you recommend a self-taught artist go about meeting other artists and making connections in the art illustration world? This is a theme that comes up a bunch in these interviews we've been doing lately. Mm-hmm. Like everybody had this like core group of friends that they went to college with. And then there's still, I mean, us three, we still have people that we've known for 20 years that we still communicate with and we're inspired by and helping out and stuff. So you didn't go to college, you're self-taught. How do you get that group? How do you make those friends?
And it's hard now. I mean, I think, you know, during the Rona times, it's been a little bit more difficult, of course, but you know, the online communities are so robust and I think just putting yourself out there and, you know, being a part of the forums like we have at SVS or, you know, at Children's Book Pro, we started a Discord and that was super successful. And a lot of those groups kind of spawned off into these little micro, smaller groups. Definitely reach out to your local community. If you live in any, even close to a big city, you've got access to some people. And most people are fine with sharing. But the big thing, the hard thing I think for artists is just reaching out in a natural way. Sometimes it doesn't feel that natural.
We started an art lunch when I was living in near Provo, Utah, at the mall. And it grew to where, I mean, I'll bet you there's easily over 100 people that have gone to that group. And they even created a book of art to sell at CTNX.
Yeah.
This last time. So, it was called Art Lunch.
I used to be jealous when I would see that on Facebook because I'd see like the post and it looked like everybody's having such a good time. And I was like, I want to do the art lunch. Didn't have anybody.
I've been a few times. They weren't having as good a time as the pictures show.
Because you came. Those were just on the times that you came, Jake.
Okay.
I only smiled during the picture.
But that's one thing, going to conventions, you know, like SCBWI or animation conventions and meeting up, you know, like going, like you said, going in forums. Like on our SVS forums, svslearn.com forums, meeting people there and then finding out who's going to be at this event and having meetups, you know, and having a night where you're all, you know, the people that you've met online go out to dinner. That's how things get started.
Yeah.
Here's my advice. And just remember ABC. Okay.
I already did ABC. You can't use my ABC.
This is the new one. So number one, means ask. So go online and ask, just ask questions. And the people that answer, those are people who are already like very giving and friendly. The people that answer, those are the people you start making friends with online and you stay in contact with. Okay. So A is ask. B, build. Build something with someone. Find people that want to do a thing together. So you make an anthology together. You make a zine together. You you teach a class together or you start something together. The reason me, Will, and Lee are such good friends is because we built SVS together. I wouldn't know Lee other than in passing if I didn't have to talk to him every single day.
Forced.
But so you build. And then C is conventions, conferences, any sort of meetup that starts with a C. And just go meet people in person when in-person things start happening again, because really that in-person bond is a way to connect to people.
Let me add to that too. This is my technique of aim low. coming up with things. Some people think that, you know, to have a community, you need to have this big group of people, kind of like what Will's talking about with withdrawal lunch. That's one way to interact with people. But I find that the bigger the group gets, the less I actually get out of it. And what I've seen over and over from the people around me who have successful art groups is 3 to 5 people, 3 being a fantastic number of people to be around. So you don't need 10, 20 artists to be a part of this big giant thing. You just have to find 2 other people that do what you do and are interested in what you're interested in. And if you need a technique when you're at these conferences and these kind of social things, the same advice I give my kid, he just started a new school, now doesn't know anybody. I said, ask, just have 3 questions at the ready. And when you meet somebody, ask them 3 questions.
Right.
And it typically goes rolling from there. And it's fantastic if it's an art group, it's easy because you already have that big shared bond. You know, who's some of your favorite artists? Do you have any of your work? Can you show it to me online? You know, just kind of come up with whatever the 3 are, but you don't need much is my point to get a lot out of it. I guess if we had a bigger group here, me, Will, and Jake, I don't know if we would have gotten all this stuff made because it becomes too cumbersome to look at that much stuff, to look at the work, to critique it all, see what everybody's doing. It becomes too much of a, you remember in school where everybody just kind of introduces himself, goes around a room, and it's 4 hours later. You can't have that. It's got to be productive. So the small numbers are great.
Yeah.
So there's an acronym. It's ABC. And you guys are wrong. It's always be closing. I got that from Julie in the comments.
Thank you.
Thank you, Julie. They made that popularized in the Glenn Ross movie, if you saw that. Anyway.
I would say too, like, raise your hand in the chat if you're looking for online people to have connection with, as far as building a group, if you need one. So, and then just reach out to that person through YouTube or email, or put your Instagram handle and you can DM you or something like that. Okay, guess how many questions we've answered so far. You guys want to wager a guess? Don't cheat.
3.
Will, how many do you think?
11.
The answer is 9. 9 questions. We've got 56 open questions.
And then how long is this thing going? Oh my gosh!
Didn't get copied out of the chat.
That's right.
The way to find your friends. People are asking about it. If you look in the go to like a bulletin board at a community college or whatever, you see people looking for band members, like drummer wanted, and they list the influences. It's got to be Metallica, Pantera, and Marie Osmond, and that's and that's how you can find your crew. List your stuff.
Yeah, that's cool. And you know what? You look at the Beatles Get Back documentary, and those 4 guys, like, the reason they're so successful, I don't think anyone on their own was particularly. I say that loosely, but particularly like could have done what they did on their own, but they did it together. And that's because you had Paul bouncing stuff off of John bouncing stuff off of Paul, George bouncing stuff off of both of them, Ringo showing up on time every day and just having a beat there when they needed it, you know? So it's like find your group.
Just a little aside, but there is, Marie Osmond did just release an album singing Metallica. So you guys Google that. It is awesome.
You're kidding me. You are kidding me. You made that up. Okay. Question. People keep hearing people saying, don't do educational books. Why is that?
I bet I know why. It's because most of them offer work for hire contracts.
Mm-hmm.
But my standard answer on that is, let's say, you know, I've heard established illustrators saying, you know, don't ever sign a work for hire. Well, if you are trying to break in and you're trying to pay your rent and there's a work for hire that's going to pay you $1,000 and it's an illustration that you can do in a couple days and you're not getting that much work and it can really help you. I sign plenty of work for hires. Are they ideal? No. And for those who don't know, you can easily Google what a work for hire contract is. That's in general probably the reason why I would assume they're giving that advice.
Yeah.
Do you want to try to not have, I mean, so the thought in the industry is the more people that sign them, the more they'll stay around and they'll never go away. Right. So we need to teach these employers, these companies that we're not going to take it, you know, we're not going to take it. But the problem is there's always someone who's going to take it. Okay. There's always someone who's going to take it. You aren't, they're probably never going to go away. What I suggest my students do is ask yourself, if you need it for the money, why are you doing it? If you don't need the money, is it going to help you in your portfolio? Is it going to help you? Can you fall in love with the illustration assignment, and can it lead to more work that's not work for hire later on? Lee's just waiting to get at this one. He's dying to get in here.
Let's hear it, Lee. Let's hear it.
I'm still thinking about Marie Osmond singing Metallica. What are we talking about?
Nothing. I answered it.
Next question.
Work for hire.
Let's see. What are the most, this is from Catherine, what are the most important steps to take in order to self-publish your own children's book and reach a lot of readers instead of getting lost among other self-published books?
Can I go back to the work for hire thing just for 1 second?
Oh, you really, okay. You really do have something to say.
I don't know. I was reading the comments, so I didn't pay attention to what Will said, but did you talk about how the art directors will basically try to illustrate through your hands in work for hire situations and the limited creativity, not just the contractual lameness of some of those educational projects, but how over art directed they are. That's my main problem.
They're some of the worst jobs often. Yes.
They will, that only on the educational books that I've been offered do they offer, I mean, there is tons of illustration notes. Like there is a grapefruit character. He's running in from the left. He's wearing a crown and he's running towards this castle made out of a pineapple. I mean, they just art direct it to death. You're basically interpreting what they are writing in.
They're
in
designed
word
by
form.
Committee. There's there's a pros and cons list there, right? I mean, the pros are you get practice, you get real world experience working with an art director. You get practice communicating, you get practice making deadlines. But you're right, Lee. I mean, like chances of you getting a really good portfolio piece, I would say, if I look back at all the educational work that I did over the years, probably pretty slim. You know, there's a few pieces that stand out. So getting a portfolio piece is probably not going to happen. Getting paid is going to happen. Mm-hmm. Getting your bills paid is going to happen, but there's an opportunity cost perhaps. What if you take that on, are you blocking out something good that could come in where you won't have time to do it? You know, those are things to think of. We see Lee got bored and he just took off. He's like,
I guess we're done. All right. Here's a question about what's the most important step. Oh boy.
Boom.
How did that make it from Tennessee to Colorado?
Somebody just said, I want to see Lee walk through the door in a hot dog costume. I don't know where anything in my house is except for this hot dog costume.
He couldn't find his Wacom pen.
I didn't draw for 6 weeks because I couldn't find my pen.
But he knows where his hot dog costume is.
I've seen you in my nightmares in that suit.
Oh boy. Okay. So the children's book thing, like what steps do you take to get your children's book to reach a lot of readers, self-published? Yeah, I guess self-published any book. What do you guys have any thoughts on that? What are the most important steps to take in order to self-publish your own children's book and reach a lot of readers instead of getting lost among other self-published books?
Understand the distribution plan first or the marketing plan first. In this day and age, it's easy to make a book. It's hard to sell a book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you need to understand that. What does 3,000 books look like in your garage? You need to understand that. I know all too well. I just had to essentially throw out probably 800 books that were left in Portland because I just couldn't bring. They were too heavy for me to bring cross country when I moved, and I didn't have the space for them. So there's all these practical aspects of it. Making the actual book is the easiest thing you could do now with easy things are to ship from other countries. Well, without the supply chain issues that we're currently facing, but it's easy to make a book, but it's hard to sell it. So understand, where are you going to sell it? For me, it was art fairs and online, and I didn't have an unreasonable expectation of what that was going to be. I didn't think it was going to be millions of copies, but it would be enough to just keep going, and it never goes out of print. So a good reason to get into self-publishing is you keep selling it over time until the edition runs out. But just understand how you're going to do that, because at some point you're going to have a bunch of books in your garage.
Yeah.
Figure out what to do.
Shout out to Travis Hansen, who's a graphic novelist. He goes to comic conventions and he has a whole line of these graphic novel series that he produces, and he launches them on a Kickstarter. He sells really well on Kickstarter, and then he takes the overprint and sells them at comic conventions, and that's his distribution, you know. And he has a career. He has a full-on income stream from doing that. I think COVID probably hurt him. You know, that was probably tough. We lost Jake.
I'm sorry. I'm reading the chat. Check this out. Murray Osmond. I'm a little bit country and nothing else matters. Oh, boy.
Oh, that's funny.
We got to do this every episode, maybe. I don't know. Okay. Did you answer the question?
I think so.
I was paying attention. I will say this. My answer to this question is, you want to have a successful self-published book, serve an underserved niche.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a whole world out there of people with ponies that have ponies. Is that what I want to say? No, there's people out there with peacocks that raise and farm out peacocks, make a book about the singing peacock or something like that. I don't know.
I will never buy that book. And you know why? We had wild peacocks at my house when I was growing up.
Yeah.
And they are the worst animals. They're pretty, but they attack like anything reflective. So they attack the cars and then they attack the windows and just scream in the morning. So you think you're going to sleep in the aggressive. Weekend.
And their call sounds like a dying mammal, like a dying cat or something like that.
Yeah, it's awful.
You know, my father-in-law, there's a wild peacock that kept running up on their back porch, and one day it was gone, and there was a interesting something soup that he had made the next day.
That's the children's book right there.
There you
Uncle
go.
Uncle Bill's soup.
Yeah. But especially if people are passionate about something. I don't know how many people are passionate about peacocks, but people are passionate about anything political, anything religious. You know, if you did a book, you know, in the Christian market that was about maybe, you know, some Bible story that nobody, that hasn't been made a children's book yet, that might do well. Or you know, just look for some sort of thing that isn't being served and go make that book. Okay. Let's see. You know what? Let's do like two more. I mean, we could go all night, but all day or whatever. But I think some people want to win the...
When are we doing the giveaway? Are we doing that?
Yeah, we got to do the giveaway. I think Daniel's gonna pick them from the... From the answers that have come in, or the
and I saw
the form.
That Lisa said we might be doing an international giveaway as well.
Okay,
there's a lot of people asking why isn't it, you know,
Daniel? Let us know in our chat, not the public chat, but our private chat, who the winners are, and we're going to answer three more questions. Katie asks, what were the last projects you worked on that pushed you outside of your comfort zone? How did you work through that? something to think about there. I'll tell you mine. Well, you guys are thinking. I'll tell you mine. The thing that pushed me. So, I got to a point with children's books where it was like, I got my system down. I know how to do this. I can make this happen. Right. Comics are harder. It's a lot more work. It's a little the storytelling aspect. And there's writing when I'm doing comics and I'm writing on them on my own. It's hard to do the writing side and the art side. And so that's why there's always like these big gaps in between the comics that I do, the graphic novels. Cause I like, I stress myself out and it's like, I finish it and I'm happy. And then I need to take a break, but I just started back on doing a comic this year and I'm like having to reteach myself. Okay, this is how you do comic book storytelling. This is how you write. This is how you, you know, do the dialogue and things like that. And really the way that, and it's pushing me. It's pushing me like I haven't been pushed in a while with my art. And the way that I'm working through it now is setting aside a certain amount of recovery time so that I don't get burned out. So I'll work on it for 2 days straight. And then 2 days, I'll take a break so that when I come back to it on Friday, you know, I'm like fresh and ready to go. And I can see clearly the mistakes that may have popped up or things I want to change and come at it fresh. And so it's just a matter of that balance between on time and off time. And I think that's how you can get through these projects that are really pushing you hard.
Give me sharing screen.
Sharon Screen. Sharon, she's an employee. Sharon Screen and Kenny log on.
Uh-oh. Yep. Is it going to let me? There we go. Can you see that?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're listening to the podcast on anything other than YouTube, you will not see this. But this was from a book I did just a few years ago, Bonaparte Plays Ball. And I've always hated crowd scenes. Hated them. Mm-hmm. Petrified.
Every illustrator
didn't know how to make it work. This is one that I was like, okay, it's in the book. Got to do it, and I got to love it. That was my criteria. I have to figure out a way to love this. And so it took a while, but I just rinse and repeated a lot of these little characters in the background, and just figured out how to really lay them back and values so that they're really nondescript. They're there, but they're not there in a real flat rendering. And so that one stretched me a little bit.
Cool. That was good.
Yeah, I guess two things recently. One, by the last book I did, Pretty Planet, had no story at all. And I needed to somehow come up with a narrative that was going to be separate from what the text was from a song. And so, but the song it wasn't a story. It was just these just pretty scenes sort of that are around the world and not even that descriptive. And so I had to come up with something. It really pushed the idea of storytelling and how to tell a story and how to tell a secondary story within a manuscript. And then lastly, a lot of my children's books seem different than the work I make for myself and they sell for prints and gallery stuff. And I wanted to make a book that had that quality too. So it didn't seem like a separate thing than the work I make for sale and gallery. And so I tried to bring all that stuff together and I think I did a pretty good job, but it just took a lot of emotional and mental energy and artistic energy too, just to try to get it out. And then we sort of ran into the same problem with when we, this past year, Jake, Will, and I built a program called Children's Book Pro, and it was years in the making, and it pushed us. So we threw out we'd come up with a syllabus and kind of what we want to teach and how we want to teach it. We'd throw it away. And like, so I figured out through doing this Pretty Planet, oh, here's how I work and here's how I'm going to tell a story, and sort of streamlined a couple of things. And then I get together with Will and Jake and say, oh, wait, here's how they do that same thing. And it sort of made me question like how I do it. And I was able to fill in some more holes in my process and stuff. So both those things together really pushed just my understanding of story and how to make images that have meaning.
All right. So do we want to do more questions or should we do the winners and call this good for episode number 100?
We've been going for about an hour and 20.
Mm-hmm.
We still got, wrap it how, up? Many how many people are here?
427.
Nuh-uh.
Right now.
There was 450.
Dang.
Yeah, that was the highest that I saw.
Peaked we need to find those people that left.
25 people saw you in a hot dog suit and immediately clicked off.
That's what did it. There's a clear,
not
moment.
What I signed up for.
They're like, what did I click on? Oh,
oh my god!
All right, let's announce our winners. Oh, actually, I got one more question. I don't think Daniel picked this one up, but I saw it's from Lucy. What books published in recent years are you guys big fans of? Like the illustrations really impressed you. We'll end on that one because I want people to like have something they can go out and find and add to their libraries if they want. Anything super impressive to you that you loved in the last couple of years?
That we're just looking at? We're not a part of making it. It's just somebody that we like?
That you're a fan of. Yeah, that people should know about, that they should see.
Man, I wish I had my books out of the boxes that are everywhere. Hold on. I'll pull it up. See if I can share and screen.
Okay. Do you have something, Will?
No, go ahead.
I was just going to go to my bookshelf and grab something.
Do it.
Okay. I'll be right back.
I'm going to be looking for stuff too. Will, you have to fill it in with singing.
No, I got it. Okay. So this right here, Beta Ray Bill. From Daniel Warren Johnson is a comic that came out over the summer, and they just released the trade paperback. And this is the perfect comic. It is so ridiculous and fun, but on the other hand, it's emotional, and there's like a heart. A core in the a heart of core a core of heart that it has. I don't know what I'm trying to say. Looking at the cover, saying? You would not think that you would care about this, but this guy has a very there's something broken with him that the story ends up fixing, and it's just wonderful. And Daniel Warren Johnson is just an amazing artist and storyteller, and I'll see if I could find like one of my favorite pages from the book so you could see what I'm talking about. I remember what it is. Check out this. So there's a part where he's got this cool ship, right? This giant ship. And there's this one part where he's flying along and cross section. He just cuts it open and we could see every room in the ship. So
you showed that in one of our classes or something.
Maybe, I don't know. But I recommend this, Beta Ray Bill. This is like, if you're not a comic reader and you want to, you're maybe like, well, let's try out comics. Read this. Okay, Lee, what do you got?
Hold on. Well, I've got the image. I just need to, hold on, let me type it in. Will, you go ahead.
I don't buy a lot of books. We go to the bookstore every now and then and I'll look around and I see a ton of work that I love. I'm going to throw out Peter Brown. Because I just love the way he solves stuff. And in a recent class that I just did for SBS, I used The Wild Robot as a comparison to what an assignment that I had given my students years back. But I love how he solves problems. He's, you know, his design is impeccable, but it doesn't feel... It still feels illustrated. So it's that it's that world in between super planned and really shape, really simple shape based illustration with, but still feels illustrative. And I really gravitate towards that.
Okay, so check out Peter Brown's work, most recent work. Good stuff. Okay, Lee, what do you got?
I'll try to share and screen. As it were, I don't know how to say her name, and so I don't really want to butcher it. But she's a French, I think.
Oh, I love her
graphic
stuff.
Novelist.
Yeah, I've seen her stuff a lot.
Most of the time when I get, here's my problem with comic shops is I go in, I get lured in by this beautiful cover, and then the inside just gives me a headache. It's not drawn in the same way. It's mm-hmm. just a bunch of images. I didn't grow up with comics that much, but when I saw her work, I was like, that cover is awesome, really evocative kind of imagery. And then I open it up and the inside just gets better and better and better. It's this quirky, weird storytelling and gorgeous images.
Can you click on that one at the bottom middle?
Bottom middle.
Very bottom.
The very bottom.
He didn't go to kindergarten on the day they taught bottom.
What do you mean bottom? You mean
look
the top?
At that. Look at that.
Of course I can't get in there.
So yeah. Look at that.
Graphic and yet so illustrative.
And it's okay. It's got its own style. It's quirky. But she's super talented. When she needs to render, she's a great designer. When she needs to render, she does. And when she needs to for it to be flat, it's flat. And she's just a pro.
It'd be so
just
cool if you were that good, Lee.
Oh, you got that right. I could only dream to be as good. I'd say all the people that I look at, every day. You know, somebody asked earlier, I saw it in the chat. What do you do when you just don't feel up to your influences? And I'll say you never will. I mean, I look at this and it just makes me tired. And you just make the work that you do and just be like, all right, she's doing these cool shapes and, you know, she's using line in a certain way. Maybe I can bring some of that stuff into my work and try it out and see how it works. And you evolve just like everybody else does. I bet she has a group of people that she looks at that she feels that way about, and they mm-hmm. do too. And it doesn't stop, you know, which is great.
Mm-hmm. All right. Should we do the winners?
Let's do the winners.
Okay,
winner,
here we
go. Chicken dinner.
Winner number one, come on down, Jennifer Comfort. Jennifer Comfort is winner number one. The prize, do you guys know what the prize is? Did you ever
something
see
really good?
It's something like really good.
Six pack?
No. It is Bonaparte, one of the Bonaparte books, This Pretty Planet, one of those books, Little Bot and Sparrow. It's What They Didn't Teach You at Art School. It's The Art of Lee White, and it's Drawings 5. So it's a 6-book package. I don't know how we're going to get all those books in one place because they're spread out across the country right now, but we'll figure it out. They get an SVS t-shirt. They get a portfolio review with us.
What? Sign on for that.
You remember we talked about that?
All right. Do it.
So we're going to sit down with them and just the three of us and have a Zoom meeting where we go over their portfolio and give them advice. And lastly, they get a 2-year subscription to SVS Learn.
So she just commented and she's there in the comments.
Yeah. Yes, Lee's like, why did we agree to all this? What are you guys talking about?
This is a lot. We should have people buy tickets like they do at the fair. And then.
This is. This is us giving back. Okay, winner number two. Are you ready? Victor Bonilla. Come on down. Bonilla. You've won.
Come on down.
Bonilla?
Probably pronounced Bonilla.
Okay. Victor Bonilla.
Can we have the winners illustrate the podcast?
If their illustrations are good.
let's we can throw that into the mix.
All right, so that's winner number two. And then winner number three, Daniel, could you have picked like people with easy to pronounce last names? Corey Like, I think it is. L-E-I-C-K. Corey Like. Leic Like, something like that. You are our third winner. Thank you so much for showing up. We have your emails. We're going to reach out to you via email. And so we can get your mailing address so we can mail these packages out to you. And I don't know when these all will get mailed out, but because we have to mail our books to one central location and get the shirts in and then get them out.
Or we just mail individually to and you can get a bunch of packages.
Oh, that might be fun. Yeah, we'll do it that way. Okay, so there's that. We got that figured out.
Somebody was asking, will we post the critique to either the forum or SVS or whatever, will we post the critique of that person's work?
If they give us permission, we'll do it.
I don't mind doing that.
Mm-hmm. We'll put it on the YouTube channel.
We'll send them a work for hire contract.
Yeah.
Kidding. Kidding.
All right. Can I end this episode?
Yes. Take us out, Jake.
Okay. First off, I just want to thank in the chat. I saw Studio Hannah. She has her own YouTube channel, so go check that out. It's really good. I don't know if she's posted lately, but the videos that have been up there are really good. The reason I bring her out is she was like answering questions left and right, the questions that we didn't get to. And she is a working illustrator and she had some good advice. So I just want to say thank you for that, Studio Hannah. I'll take us out. All right, everybody, thank you for joining us. 3-Point Perspective is brought to you by svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. Your hosts today have been Will Terry, Lee White, and Jake Parker. Will Terry's work can be found at willterry.com and Will Terry Illustration. No, what is it? At Will Terry on art. At Will Terry Art on.
At Will Terry Art.
On Instagram. 100 episodes that I still don't have it memorized. You can find Lee White's work at leewhiteillustration.com and at leewhiteillo on Instagram, and my work's at mrjakeparker.com and at Jake Parker on Instagram. Okay, special thanks to Daniel too, who completely was our, like, came in clutch today for everything on getting us the questions and doing everything here. Hold on, I'm getting a call. I got to turn that off. Special thanks to Daniel 2 for that. You can find his work at daniel2.co. That's T-U.co. Special thanks to our SVS Master of, what do we call it? Master of Production. That's David Bro. Special thanks to our Master of Curriculum, Austin Shirtliff. Special thanks to our Master of Operations, Lisa Fott. And a special thanks to Lily Camille for all of our show notes. And I think that's it. All right, everybody, thank you for joining us. Now go draw something.